Sportsmarket.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The U.S. dollar has taken a long slide in the last 2 years and a real swoon in the last few months. Yesterday, it briefly hit a record low against the euro, just enough slide, and U.S. exporters celebrate too much, and we've got a crisis. Tonight on Point, Morgan Stanley chief economist Stephen Roach on the incredible shrinking dollar. But first, former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill today tried to pour some cold water on the political fires he set off in a new tell-all book about his 2 years in the Bush administration. O'Neill now says the Bush administration was not wrong to begin contingency planning for Iraq, that he regretted any unflattering comments about President Bush, and that he did not give the book's author, Ron Suskind, classified materials. But O'Neill's sharp criticisms in The Price of Loyalty still have Washington in a stir. Michael Duffy is Washington Bureau Chief for Time Magazine and joins me now with the latest chapter in the O'Neill page turner. Good evening and welcome, Michael Duffy.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
It's good to have you. So here we are today, Donald Rumsfeld talking about it, O'Neill himself talking about it. How big a rock in the pond has Paul O'Neill's book with Ron Suskind been in and around the White House?
Well, it's the kind that you can sort of pick up, but just barely heavy. I mean, there hasn't been a book by an insider in this administration in the 3 years that President Bush has been in office, and there hasn't been one in probably 10 or 15 years by someone who is critical of the person he worked for. You probably have to go back to David Stockman's book in the early 1980s. So it's a fairly big deal, especially in a White House where they have a lock on any kind of message coming out, and he really has broken the code.
So is Paul O'Neill really backtracking today?
Well, I think he's backtracking on his personal criticisms of the president's, what he regarded as the president's lack of curiosity, but not on some of the other things he said by any means. I think the quote that he was particularly, he was wincing at, is he said that at one point that the president was like a blind man in a room full of deaf people, and he winces at that comment. He wishes that perhaps Bush was a little cleverer than he gave him credit for, letting his aides kind of go on and on when he knew what he was going on all along. But he didn't sense that at the time, and so he's not taking back much else in the book.
And, of course, the other big piece coming out of this is getting a lot of attention is his suggestion, allegation, you put the word to it, that the White House was planning to go after Saddam Hussein essentially from day one.
He has said two things, I think, in that regard that are important. First, he said that regime change was the policy from the minute he walked in. That was true, actually. Even Clinton's policy was regime change in Iraq. O'Neill added another layer on the cake and saying, looked to me like we were looking for a reason from the moment we got in there. And the other thing he said was that he never saw any evidence in 23 months in office and on the National Security Council that any evidence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, despite what the administration would come to say. So both of those are fairly hefty criticisms, but I think the second one is actually a bit more pointed, since the policy was well known.
The policy
of regime change, that had been the policy in early Bush before 9/11. It had been the policy of Clinton. I think that's been overstated a bit.
Maybe overstated. The way he puts it, just to quote from the book, he says, from the start, we were building the case against Hussein and looking at how we could take him out and change Iraq into a new country. And if we did that, it would solve everything. It was about finding a way to do it. That was the tone of it, the president saying, fine, go find me a way to do this. It may have been the same formal policy as the Clinton administration, but one doesn't really picture Bill Clinton saying, fine, find me a way to invade Iraq.
No, although I'm not sure invade was the word Bush was using here. I think
fair enough.
We were always funding people to overthrow the government, but it was always a joke. What's I think intriguing about O'Neill is for that charge he doesn't have a lot of evidence. Although I think it's widely believed that was probably true at the time.
And then we
would have liked one good conversation with the president in the book. I would have liked one good conversation in which the president says this. That
would have helped. A little more straightforward fashion.
We know that Bush, for example, said in early 2002. I'm taking Saddam out, long before there was ever a real finding to do so. That's been reported. But O'Neill suggests that that kind of attitude and that kind of comment was operative a year before that.
Paul O'Neill says in the book that he wants to get the truth out. He's not worried about where the chips may fall. He says, I'm an old guy and I'm rich and there's nothing they can do to hurt me. The Treasury Department is now looking at whether or not he made public secret documents. Is he really vulnerable here? Is this posturing? What's going on?
I doubt it. I think this is a 2 or 3 day flap generated by a piece of tape in the 60 Minutes interview on Sunday, which had a classified stamp on a document. There's no indication that ever came from O'Neill, nor is there ever any indication in the book that there was a classified document involved that I can tell looking at the book. I think the really interesting thing is that O'Neill, and people don't realize this, O'Neill and Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, these guys were all grew up together in the Ford administration and the Nixon administration. They were really close buddies 25 years ago, and the reason O'Neill was brought back primarily is because O'Neill and Rumsfeld and Cheney and Alan Greenspan all used to hang out together, and Cheney was looking for someone whom Greenspan could work with and trust.
But O'Neill appears to have felt frozen out in this administration, even while he was in it.
Right, because he's actually far less political than those guys, always much more outspoken, much more straight, shoot from the hip. And one of the things that Cheney had been looking for in a Treasury Secretary was someone who could talk to the markets. But that's a job for sort of like a horse whisperer. Mm-hmm. You remember that movie?
Yes, someone I do. And Paul O'Neill is not exactly the subtle.
It's the opposite. It's a funny thing. Cheney completely misread the job and picked what had to be the opposite of a horse whisperer. And even now, as he's writing his book, you can see that that's not his style of communicating.
Michael Duffy, what's your sense of where this is headed? Is Paul O'Neill going to be quoted all the way up to the presidential election day in November?
Oh, yes. This is now, in many ways, it's going to be the book on him. And for those people who think that, George Bush is an incurious cipher, here's proof. And I think that on the other side, the White House will dismiss him now publicly the way they dismissed him privately during his 23 months in office. And so the war that, I think has been going on about O'Neill, it's pretty much ever since he got in, will just continue. But he will probably be, by the end of this, he'll probably be on Pacifica Radio by the end of the month, the way things are going.
With Che Guevara posters behind him. Michael Duffy, thanks for joining us tonight.
Okay, thank you.
Michael Duffy is Washington Bureau Chief for Time Magazine. He spoke with us from Washington. Currencies rise and fall. Lately, the U.S. dollar has fallen a lot. So far, the greenback's retreat has been orderly. Most agree it has boosted the U.S. economy. American manufacturers, whose products are now cheaper abroad, are delighted. And President Bush is basking in their pleasure. But falling currencies can also be a risk factor. And when the currency belongs to a global economic superpower, those risks can be large. Some now fear a dollar meltdown that could take the world economy with it. Tonight on Point, Morgan Stanley. Chief economist Stephen Roach talks about the weak dollar, what caused it, who it affects, and the risks and rewards it carries. Did you know that the greenbacks in your wallet are worth less globally than last year? Have you seen how little the dollar buys these days in London, in Paris, in Toronto? Is the fall of the dollar scaring you, or is it long overdue? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Stephen Roach, Chief Economist and Director of Global Economic Analysis at Morgan Stanley. He's one of Wall Street's most respected economists and forecasters. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Roach.
Good evening, Tom.
It's great to have you with us. Also joining us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Welcome, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
So, Stephen Roach, take us into this. We've seen a lot of swoon here, down 40% in the last couple of years, a low against the euro yesterday, many ramifications of this. But first of all, what's happening with the dollar? Is someone driving it down, or is it driving down all on its own?
Well, Tom, the dollar is a relative price. It's a comparison of the value of the U.S. economy and U.S. assets vis-a-vis those elsewhere around the world. And the plain fact of the matter is that over the 1995 to 2002 period, a seven-year period, the world became extraordinarily lopsided. The United States accounted for almost all of the cumulative increase in the world's overall economic growth. Mm. And the result of that was this huge balance of payments deficit that America has, the likes of which we've never had, the likes of which the world has never seen before.
And that continues to this day.
And it continues to this day. And so what economics wants to do is when the world gets lopsided, the markets want to change the relative price structure of the global economy. The dollar is the most important relative price, and it's going down. And in my view, it's going to keep going down until the world becomes a more balanced place.
More balanced in terms of balance of trade in particular? Are you saying until the U.S. has something nearer of a balanced current account with all that trade going on around the world?
Well, the balance will show up eventually in an improved deficit with the rest of the world. But most importantly, a weaker dollar will begin to put pressure on the United States to figure out how to export again and perhaps raise interest rates somewhat in the U.S., and so that'll cut back on our consumption growth a little bit, which has been running very excessively. And a stronger euro and a stronger yen, which is the flip side of a weaker dollar, will put the exact opposite pressure on the Japans and Europes of the world and force them to figure out how to stimulate their domestic consumption, which they have been so far unwilling or unable to do.
When people look at the falling U.S. dollar, Stephen Ertz, they talk about the twin deficits, the trade deficit being one, but the big federal deficit being the other. How does that figure in, and how important is it in the dollar slide?
I think it's absolutely critical. I mean, America right now suffers from the most severe shortage of national savings in our modern-day post-World War II history, Tom. When I measure national savings, I look at the savings of businesses, consumers, and, of course, the government sector combined, which is now running a massive deficit. And that national savings rate is as close to zero, adjusted for depreciation, as it's ever been. So how do we grow? We have to import surplus savings from overseas, and we have to run these massive trade deficits to attract that foreign capital to grow our economy. So these two deficits go hand in hand with one another.
At this point, then, I guess, paint the cause and effect for us. Is it foreign investors not willing to put the amount of money into the United States that they have been? Is that what directly leads to the dollar's fall?
Well, what happens here is now we have this balance of payments deficit that is so huge that to finance it, we are asking foreign investors to send their capital to us to the tune of about $2 billion per business day. Now, that's a lot. That's per business day. And so there comes a point when foreign investors who see the value in their own currencies of their investments in our dollar stocks or bonds or what have you declining enough where they're going to want to be compensated for taking the currency risk. And they're going to want us to give them higher rates of return for taking that risk. That bids our interest rates up, and that puts pressure on our bond market and on our stock market. And if it becomes disruptive, then that could have a serious impact on the fundamental underpinnings of the U.S. economy. So that's the risk when you are as dependent on foreigners to grow your economy as we are today. Then it's all a confidence game, because in the end, what is the dollar? The dollar is a currency backed not by gold, not by silver, but by faith in the American system. And if foreigners lose that faith, then we're in trouble.
So some slide, Jack Beatty, welcomed, especially by American exporters, but too much, and we've got a vote of no confidence.
Yes, and you know, if you step back from this, there's really a disturbing pattern. I mean, in the post-war era, we had uneven development, but it worked for everyone, the developing economies as well as the United States. But since those economies recovered in the 1960s, we've had what one scholar calls uneven development in reverse. And what that means is really that the global economy has an overcapacity in manufacturing. And periodically, in order to rectify these balances, these devaluations or drops in the dollar are necessary. The most dramatic one was the Plaza Accord of 1985. Mm-hmm. And what really happens with these episodes is that it's more like beguile thy neighbor growth with the manufacturing economy of one nation flourishing only at the expense of the manufacturing economy of another. And we're in that sort of cycle right now. And it goes right to something very, very basic in contemporary capitalism.
Well, some are celebrating, some are warning. It could mean trouble. We're talking this hour about the incredible shrinking dollar, its causes and its consequences for the U.S. economy. Our guest is Stephen Roach, Chief Economist and Director of Global Economic Analysis at Morgan Stanley. You can join the conversation as well. Is the fall of the dollar scaring you, or is it overdue? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the incredible shrinking dollar, its causes and its consequences for the U.S. economy, for the world economy. Our guest tonight, Stephen Roach. He joins us from New Canaan, Connecticut. He's Chief Economist and Director of Global Economic Analysis at Morgan Stanley. You can join our conversation as well tonight. Is it worth a weaker dollar to make U.S. exports more attractive abroad? Can you imagine foreign investors really fleeing from the dollar and the U.S. deficits behind it? Or is the United States impervious to a real run on its currency? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Stephen Roach, there are a lot of interpretations of what's going on here. As you poke into this, there are things that build confidence. There are also things that can be pretty scary. On balance, as I understand it, you have welcomed the slide of the dollar so far. Why?
Well, as long as the decline, Tom, is gradual and manageable, the world does need to change relative prices to become a more balanced and stable place.
That is, so it's not just China and Japan churning out the exports in the United States just buying, but something closer to a...
more to the world than just the American consumer buying things that are made in China.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do welcome a realignment in the relative price structure, but the risk, as we've already discussed, is that... something disruptive could happen that could cause a significant jolt to confidence. And given the magnitude of our trade deficits, the dollar's adjustment could accelerate very dramatically. And that would be very, very disruptive, and I would be very worried about that.
We'll look at that risk in a moment. But first, the upside. How much further do you think the dollar might descend? Is it really descending against the Chinese currency, the yuan, because that's pegged to the dollar? So does that mean that Chinese products just get cheaper as the dollar falls? More questions, but those two first.
Well, the dollar, in my opinion, is probably about halfway down in its descent against a broad basket of the currencies of countries that...
Euro, pound...
The euro, the pound, Swiss franc, mm-hmm. Japanese yen, a lot of Asian currencies, the Canadian dollar, Mexican peso, you
mm-hmm.
name it.
Mm-hmm.
But this journey is probably about halfway over at best, given the magnitude of the world's imbalances.
So it's going to get, just an aside, but it's going to get a lot more expensive for Americans to travel abroad before this is all over, in your view.
I think that's a reasonable thing to expect, and that will definitely... help in curtailing a lot of the excesses of our domestic consumption.
So if it's got half of the distance still to go, how big is the trade deficit now, and how big a bite do you think that fall might eventually take out of it? How much might it change that balance?
Well, our trade deficit right now is in excess of $500 billion. To put that in order of magnitude, that's about 5% of the size of our economy, or a dollar amount that's equivalent to the size of the economy of Australia. So we're not talking about a small pittance here.
Huge.
It's absolutely enormous. And I think if the dollar goes down another 10 to 15% on the broadest indexes that we have against all of our trading partners, that will definitely begin to turn the corner in this external imbalance, as we call it, and cut it from 5 or 6% of our national product down to the 2 to 3% range. I think the likelihood of getting it all the way back to zero is exceedingly low for the foreseeable future.
And what about China? Their currency, the yuan, is pegged to the dollar. Does that mean that the falling dollar makes no difference in terms of making U.S. products more saleable, more competitive in China itself?
Well, I think that's an important point to note here. A lot of people are pointing the finger at China for causing these trade deficits and the weak dollar. I think that is completely wide of the mark. The Chinese currency has not changed one iota with the dollar since 1994.
So it's dancing right down with the dollar.
So it goes down with the dollar. But by the way, from the fall, the spring of 1995, it rode the dollar all the way up, which put a huge amount of pressure on the Chinese economy. So it's a bit of a round trip here. And China certainly has extraordinary capacity to export, but you have to keep in mind that over the last decade, about two-thirds of Chinese export growth is traceable to Chinese subsidiaries of multinational corporations from the United States, Japan, and Europe. So it's just as much our companies as it is Chinese companies that are doing so well because of this peg with the Chinese renminbi.
So a chance that the dollar will go down half yet again, and a chance at something like cutting that current account, that trade deficit in half, though that's a big task. We hear that, Stephen Roach. I want to welcome into our conversation from Chevy Chase, Maryland, Ted Truman. He's senior fellow at the Institute for International Economics, former assistant secretary of the U.S. Treasury for International Affairs. Good evening and welcome, Ted Truman.
Well, thank you for having me, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. Ted, Stephen Roach has pointed out that there are upsides and downsides here. We've talked a bit about the upside and how it might trim the trade deficit. Robert Rubin was with us a couple of weeks ago talking about some of the downside, and he's been making even more noise about that lately, former U.S. Treasury Secretary. He is warning this week that there is a chance at a real, what he calls a very substantial risk to the economy, of seriously threatening set of economic impacts from not a gradual decline of the dollar, but a real plummeting of the dollar. How great is that risk, and what does that scenario look like, Ted Truman?
Well, I think it is a very substantial risk, as Bob Rubin says. There are no sure things in this business. But in the face, especially in the face of our large budget deficit, as Steve has said, we have a problem that we have inadequate savings to generate the economy. The risk is that our fiscal situation is sufficiently out of control that in addition to
that is federal deficits.
Federal deficit is out of control. That the need to rebalance the economy and the global economy that Steve has referred to comes on the back of, which is there, and I think is the fundamental factor that's driving the dollar down at this point, is there will be a risk of a loss of confidence in U.S. policies. And that is the major factor that could contribute to a period of free fall in the dollar.
And what would that look like? Americans have never been through something like that. Maybe the world has never been through a fall like that.
Well, we actually had some experiences like that in the late 1980s. One was associated with, though it's not clear that not all economists would agree was caused by, associated with the stock market crash in October of 1987.
Was the dollar really in free fall in the late 80s?
Yes, it was in free fall in the late 80s. I mean, they were exactly the same pattern so far that we've had here. 2 years of very gradual fall in 1985 and 1986. And in 1987, things got quite messy. And it continued all the way through into the early first half of 1988.
Now, we survived that.
Is
Bob Rubin, is the IMF last week, are they warning of something on that scale or a greater threat?
We survived, but we also was a period, much like where we are now, where we had a budget deficit, and we had an extended period of high interest rates and slow growth. It didn't cause, I think, the recession of 1991, but there was slow growth going into that recession. The oil price increase caused the recession, but there was very slow growth during that period and very slow growth coming out of that period, and it was because we were having to constrain our absorption of resources and inadequate savings of finance investment. Mm-hmm.
Stephen Roach, as I spoke with Bob Rubin, he seemed, to my ear at least, to be warning of something worse than we saw in the late 80s and early 90s, of a kind of real spiral downward where, the money was not coming into the United States. The currency went into a kind of free fall that filtered back through exporting companies abroad, and everything just kind of ground to a halt, sort of the whole world looking like Argentina all of a sudden.
Well, Tom, we don't want to paint a scenario where it sounds like the world's coming to an end. But the precedent that Ted cited it's just important to give that credit for an example of how this dynamic can play out. And the problem with that comparison, though, is actually things are worse today in terms of our balance of payments deficit, in terms of our national savings rate, by a wide margin than they were back then. That doesn't guarantee that we're going to have a crisis or a loss of confidence, but it does say that if those expectations were to unfold, the adjustments could be far more severe than they were back in the late summer and fall of 1987. The imbalances we have in our economy today and the lack of a savings cushion to help us finance our economy in the absence of foreign capital is very, very unnerving. So we're really playing with a loaded gun here, and what worries me is that at the root cause of this, I think, is just totally reckless and irresponsible fiscal policies coming out of Washington, and there seems to be no end in sight on that score.
Well, I said Argentina, and you said let's not get too inflammatory here. Is there a risk of that kind of meltdown in the United States, or is the United States, by dint of its stature in the world economy, impervious to an Argentina-style meltdown?
No one's impervious to anything, but we're not Argentina. We're certainly the dominant economy in the world. We have the bulk of the official foreign exchange reserves in the world, and we do have a system, an economic system, market-driven, which from time to time goes astray, and we do make mistakes. But it's the best system around that others are trying to emulate. And at this point, foreign investors have, and this would include foreign central banks as well as private investors, are willing to continue to recycle their capital back into dollar-based assets. But you have to ask yourself, how long will they be willing to do that, given some of the shaky conditions that we just took you through?
Jack Beatty, you described earlier a kind of new set of circumstances that are making nobody happy in terms of manufacturing and stabilizing economies. Have you heard an answer to that in our conversation so far, or have you still got a question in the middle of that observation?
Well, I mean, I just do think that there is this problem of overcapacity in manufacturing, really, since the 1960s, and that this is haunting the world economy. I mean, the Economist estimated in 2000 that in autos alone there's a 30% unused capacity. So these imbalances inevitably arise when we're all fighting for too few customers, you could say, for the manufacturing plant that we have. But I want to go back a bit to this fiscal issue. In his new book, Paul O'Neill reports a conversation with Alan Greenspan mm-hmm. in the spring of 2001, where Greenspan says, calls the Bush tax cuts, which were then put through without any break in them, that is to say, if they didn't pay for themselves,
they went ahead anyway.
Supply side aegis, that they were going to go ahead anyways. Mm-hmm. Senator Snow and others, other Republicans actually in Congress, wanted that mechanism in there. The Bush refused it. Greenspan called that fiscally irresponsible. That's 2001. Those tax cuts are going to be the making them permanent is going to be Mr. Bush's agenda as soon as the Congress comes back, from what I understand. And that means making permanent the cut in, say, the elimination of the estate tax, which means that when that sad day when Bill Gates dies, the $50 billion or so that would have come to the Treasury is going to go to his heirs. Now, that is, if it was fiscally irresponsible.
And Bill Gates, we should note, doesn't even want that to happen.
That's right. If it were fiscally irresponsible in the spring of 2001, and you could really make a case there that tax cuts were really needed to stimulate the economy, how much more irresponsible would it be to make them permanent today in light of these complicated connections with foreign currencies and interest rates and lending that we've just heard?
Ted Truman, speak to that. How closely do you think foreign investors are now watching U.S. tax policy, the prospect, the possibility of making these tax cuts permanent? Could that be a trigger?
It is certainly an important background factor, among other, and it's receiving a lot of criticism from abroad from foreign officials, including in Europe. I do think there's one other aspect of this that we sort of left out. We tend to think about this all in terms of the foreigner. But domestic residents have a lot more claims on the United States than foreigners do.
Mm-hmm.
And we could, you and I could lose confidence in our policy. Or
And do what? Start investing in Japanese yen?
Yeah, we could start investing in Japanese yen. And because of fiscal policy, or we thought it was a better investment relative to the deteriorating state of the U.S. economy. So I think it's unreasonable and probably unrealistic in some sense to think about this all as a function of we have to entice the foreigners. We also have to convince U.S. residents who have most of their wealth in the United States, and they probably will keep it there.
Mm-hmm. To stick with the dollar.
Keep it in the dollar and dollar assets in the United States. But to, those people also have, they actually do send them money abroad. We buy American citizens and corporations put money abroad.
A headline in the Wall Street Journal today, How You Can Play the Falling Dollar. And it's talking about how to move your money abroad. Ted Truman, stand by for just a moment. I want to get a little feel for the upside here, because there is an upside. We're joined from New York right now by Thomas Matthews. He's executive editor of Wine Spectator. Tom Matthews, give us just a sense of how U.S. wine producers are seeing the dollar's fall.
Well, they're happy about it. It has been a brutal wine market in the U.S. over the last few years. Volume is actually growing, consumption is growing, but prices have been falling, and suddenly they have an opportunity, and they are going to take advantage of it.
So is everybody in Germany and France and the U.K. going to be drinking California wine now?
Well, maybe not France, but the U.K. certainly. That's our largest export market.
Do you hear wine producers in the United States now explicitly talking about this decline in the dollar as their new competitive edge in exporting?
You know, we don't export all that much wine, about $550 million a year. That's a very small piece of the pie, but it's an important source of revenue for a number of our major wine companies like Gallo, like Mondavi, like Kendall Jackson, and they are going to aggressively pursue those opportunities.
And the flip side, I guess, then that you're referring to is wines from overseas will become more expensive, so American consumers are likely to push their dollars toward American wines.
Wine imports are at a historic high in terms of their market share in the U.S. wine market right now, about almost 25%. A historic average puts that really closer to 21%, and it's been as low as 15%. Most of this is currency fluctuation, and I'm sure that it's just going to roll back again as it has in the past.
So there's one sector that's happy tonight with that lower dollar and exports up and imports being kept at bay. Maybe one little piece of a change in the balance of payments there. Thomas Matthews, executive editor, Wine Spectator, thanks for joining us tonight.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Stephen Urch, there's a happy man. What other sectors will be most immediately and positively touched or have been already by the dollar's fall?
Well, Tom, all of our manufacturing sectors certainly do compete on the basis of currency translated pricing in foreign markets. So there will eventually, and I stress the word eventually, be some benefits that flow through. But you know the dollar now is as you said at the outset, over 2 years into its downward descent. And America's manufacturing sector is still hurting. Jobs were down again in the manufacturing sector in the month of December, as reported a few days
ago. Just last week, so it hasn't solved the problem yet. Stephen Roach, Ted Truman, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the falling dollar and its causes and its consequences. You can join the conversation. Can you imagine foreign investors really fleeing from the dollar and the U.S. deficits behind it? Are you cutting back on French wine and Swiss chocolate? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the incredible shrinking dollar, its causes and its consequences for the U.S. economy, for the world economy. My guest tonight, Stephen Roach, Chief Economist and Director of Global Economic Analysis at Morgan Stanley. Ted Truman is with us. He's Senior Fellow at the Institute for International Economics, former Staff Director, the Division of International Finance of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, and our own Jack Beatty is here. You can join us as well. Do you trust the Bush administration to handle this right, and what's the evidence so far? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Preston is calling from Boston. Hi, Preston. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a quick question. I've actually got lots of thoughts. First of all, have you ever heard of the saying, If you owe the bank a dollar, the bank owns you. If you owe the bank a million, you own the bank.
So does that make the United States the unsinkable ship, Preston?
I think that might be part of it. But you did ask whether or not there were any concerns. And my primary concern is that if the bank, all of these other countries like China, for example, with big trade surplus, who own a lot of our foreign debt, decide
yes.
that they're not happy with the depreciation of the dollar, hence the return on that investment,
mm-hmm.
and they decide that they want to sell off those treasury obligations. I think, I'm not sure what the number is, but it's got to be, you know, billions,
vast.
If not trillions of dollars that they owe. What effect does that have on interest rates? I would assume it causes interest rates to go up. And then what effect does that have on the economy? Going back to your previous guest who was talking about the wine thing,
yes.
I think it could be very short-sighted to think that this is going to be good, because if in the long term the consumer impact is negative, people won't have money to spend on wine.
A lot of questions there, not the least of which also means American producers could jack up their prices of wine if they're higher overseas, and we might look at inflation. Lots on the table there, Preston. Let us pick it up. Stephen Roach, first of all, this question of what if China, Japan, others say we're not comfortable here, we want to sell a bunch of these treasury bonds that we're holding. A, can they do that? Dare they do that? And B, if they did, what would happen?
Well, Tom, we just completely lulled ourselves into complacency, saying they wouldn't dare do that because it would be disruptive to them and to us. And so we've got them; they'll just keep buying our bonds, and we'll keep buying their goods. And so it's pretty much a devil's pact to just keep these imbalances going. I don't believe that for a second. There just comes a point where these risks do become very worrisome, and especially with a lot of politicians in Washington now bashing China, threatening to put huge tariffs on Chinese products sold in the United States. If those measures go through, or if we do, and we recently put some quotas on textile products, mm-hmm. if we continue to bash China, why should they keep buying our paper?
But China has done very well from this relationship with the United States. Presumably they want to keep the big machine chugging along. I mean, isn't the argument that they would shoot themselves in the foot a strong one? Doesn't it push their tolerance up to a level that it would never be otherwise?
China wants to be a responsible global citizen. All I'm saying, though, is if our politicians go down the road of protectionism
mm-hmm.
And raise tariffs on Chinese products sold in the United States, then they'll ask themselves, what do we get out of continuing to buy U.S. Treasury bonds? And all they need to do, they don't even need to sell them. They simply need
to stop buying.
And then our interest rates are going to go up, and your commentator on wine is going to feel the pain that you described. Maybe his pricing's a little bit better, but the interest rate effects are going to severely crimp Americans from buying much of anything.
Offset that. Ted Truman, speak to the interest rate threat here. Alan Greenspan is described as having essentially underwritten the dollar's descent because he's kept American interest rates so low. Might we see a kind of whiplash here where the dynamic turns around and forces them up?
Well, I think you need to talk about two interest rates. One is the interest rate that the Federal Reserve controls, which is the overnight interest rate, and the other is the market interest rates,
mm-hmm.
which people like Steve's clients control in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
They are linked, but they're not tightly linked. And it is inevitable, even under the best of circumstances, that interest rates over the medium term as part of this adjustment process will be higher than they otherwise would be.
Because the dollar has fallen, because the deficits are so large.
No, actually, because we are basically consuming and investing in the United States more than we're producing. And what mm-hmm. it means to narrow the current account deficit is that we're going to have to produce more and consume less.
So if interest rates go up...
And raising interest rates is part of that process.
Does that turn around the dollar's fall because now foreign investors are happier to put it in?
It may have some marginal effect, but once the dollar is in, this is where Argentina is relevant, if I put it that way, once the currency is in free fall, modest interest and increases in interest rates don't really help it. Mm-hmm. But I think the basic point is, and this is part of the adjustment process, it's inevitable, and we shouldn't, you know, cry about it, but it's inevitable. There is going to be, the impact will be, there will be higher interest rates, and that means mortgage payments will be higher. And you will look for an industry that is impacting negatively, go to the construction, the home construction industry. It's been booming over the last 2 or 3 years. I would suspect over the next 2 or 3 years it will be under severe, somewhat greater pressure and certainly will not be expanding as rapidly as it has been over this year. It's because we have to cut back on our aggregate consumption.
And interest rates will help force that to happen.
They're not part of saving the dollar. They're part of stabilizing the economy.
Looking to the underlying fundamentals there, I want to turn to another caller. Carl is on the line from Boston. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Hi there. I'm just wondering if Keynes is finally dead. Here we've entered into a recession, and wouldn't it have been sort of traditional fiscal policy to cut taxes and jack up spending?
So you're saying, why bash the deficits? We needed them to get out of the recession. Stephen Roach, how about that?
Well, I don't think it has anything to do with Keynes. I just think it has to do with the American political cycle and a Fed chairman that moved very aggressively, mindful of the tragedy that was Japan, to cut interest rates as dramatically as he could once the bubble that he created popped.
To avoid Japan's long years of stagnation.
Stagnation and deflation. But, you know, look, there's more to this story that has yet to unfold. And here we have the overnight lending rate at literally 1%.
Sort of 50-year low.
And exactly. So if something bad were to happen again and we needed some monetary stimulus, the Federal Reserve Board is basically out of ammunition. So we are on very, very thin ice with respect to counting on the Fed and even the fiscal authorities in Washington to do much to help the economy out if we do get into another round of unexpected difficulty.
But Stephen Roach, what about the Bush administration's policy on the dollar? What is it? Are they happy with the dollar's fall? Have they said, are they pushing it one way or another? Do they have the capacity to?
Well, you know, we have this really weird rhetorical aspect to our currency policy that was taken to a real art form by one of your guests a few weeks ago, former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin, talking about the so-called strong dollar policy. Secretary John Snow has attempted to finesse that, certainly not pounded the table with the rhetorical flourish that has characterized strong dollar policy statements in the past. So the markets have taken the message that the United States is on board with a gradual unwinding of the dollar. And public officials from Alan Greenspan to Secretary Snow to even the president, I think, have sent the message that they're reasonably comfortable with an orderly adjustment in the currency. So this does represent a change in policy, but it's a subtle change. And if you got them on this show, they'd probably tell you there was no change.
And very quickly, Stephen Roach, look a couple years out. If the dollar continues an orderly decline, how are Americans likely to feel that in their own financial economic lives?
Well, I think Americans will definitely be feeling the weight of somewhat higher interest rates. They'll be consuming somewhat less. They'll be saving more. And ultimately, that's what we need to do to set the stage for more sustainable, longer-term growth.
And Ted Truman, how lightly or well are you sleeping at night these days? The plummet scenario, how real?
Well, much more lightly than I did when I used to be at the Federal Reserve. I've been through this several times on the firing line, so I'm sleeping much more soundly.
Glad not to be there right now.
But I think it's going to be a very difficult period, and we need to be, and the government officials need to be very careful. You cannot, although some sectors of the U.S. economy will benefit from this. On the whole, in some sense, the impact will be negative, and we shouldn't say that. I mean, it's inevitable, but we've been sort of living beyond our means externally, and we now have to adjust back to that, and that's going to be painful. And devaluation in and of itself is not an answer. I mean, it's part of an answer to a broader puzzle. But you can't devalue your way to prosperity. And Steve is absolutely right. You have to do some other things at the same time. You have to increase savings, and that means address the fiscal, the budget situation here in Washington.
One wonders if we'll do that, but we hear there's a message in this falling dollar, and we got it tonight. Ted Truman, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Ted Truman, Senior Fellow at the Institute for International Economics, and Stephen Roach, wonderful to have you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a real pleasure.
Stephen Roach, Chief Economist at Morgan Stanley. Jack Beatty, thanks for being along.
Thank you.
In a moment, a young business journalist reacts to Donald Trump's new reality TV show, The Apprentice. This is On Point. More than 18.5 million viewers tuned into Donald Trump's new reality TV series, The Apprentice, last week. That audience meant the best ratings for a reality show premiere in over a year. The program features 16 young business go-getters competing for a six-figure job in the Trump empire. New York University business journalism student Daniel Binder was one of those who tuned in for the first episode of The Apprentice. In this radio diary, he shares his response.
Do you want to watch The Apprentice tonight? My fiancé asked me for the third time. Apparently, she's forgotten that I've said no the first two times. She assumes I would be interested in watching it. After all, I used to work in corporate America. The Apprentice is about corporate America. I'm trying to make it in New York. The Apprentice is about making it in New York. She likes reality shows. I like her. Reality shows like The Apprentice are the new pop culture, and I've always told her that I love pop culture. But when I said pop culture, I meant intellectual pop culture, like The Simpsons and SpongeBob SquarePants. The dopey, good-natured stupidity of primetime has been supplanted by bug-eating reality shows. The new Bachelorette went to my high school. My God, that makes four people I've known who've been on these things. I stop mid-rant. The preview for The Apprentice is on, and this time something strikes me. Suddenly, I see the show a bit differently. Ivy League MBAs and high school dropout entrepreneurs compete on a level playing field. They're going to be judged on their performance, not their pedigree. Regardless of however absurd and artificial, this is a meritocracy. Okay, I say to my fiancé, let's watch it. The Apprentice is a 13-week-long job interview with Donald Trump. Contestants are divided into teams which compete on varying business projects. Eight men and eight women from around the U.S. with widely differing backgrounds compete for a one-year contract as the president of one of Donald Trump's companies. The applicants live together in a fancy Trump suite, and we viewers witness their emotional undoing. They need to work with each other to survive, but must betray each other for their self-preservation. This show rewards shrewdness in dealing with others, building consensus, and knowing when to create distance from failure. It favors those who excel at office politics. The first challenge for the contestants is selling lemonade. Given $250 to start a business, the men's team competes with the women's team to see who can make the most money by the end of the day. The task highlights gender differences as the men realize. In their drab business suits, they woefully watch the women jump around in miniskirts to celebrate the assignment. Sex, we learn, sells lemonade. The men get off to a quick start. They delegate tasks and create strategic business alliances. Harvard MBA Kwame Johnson has picked a quiet part of the seaport near the Fulton Street Fish Market, and customers are sparse. In contrast, the women have come to a plan through consensus. They've picked a better location in Midtown Manhattan and resort to kissing customers and giving out their phone numbers for $5 glasses of lemonade. Apparently, their confidence was well-founded. The Apprentice feels like watching a train wreck in slow motion. But it begs the question, what does it take to get ahead in corporate America? By ignoring education, contestants are forced to rely on who they are. And with its emphasis on results, The Apprentice in many ways puts a mirror up to healthy competition, an ugly yet essential component of the marketplace. Perhaps the show does measure in an extremely simplified way what success in business requires. Still, watching it makes me feel like I just ate a bad jelly donut. Woozy on sugar and sick to my stomach. I tell my fiancé this, and she just rolls her eyes.
Daniel Binder studies business journalism at New York University. He hails from Portland, Oregon. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.